Last spring, there was a lot of upheaval in local law enforcement agencies over allegations of sexual misconduct within the organizations themselves, from a lawsuit filed by a former crime analyst against the chief of police in Independence to charges of sexual battery against an officer in KCK, to the resignation of Jackson County Sheriff Mike Sharp. But at the same time, the number of women joining the police force is on the rise. In fact, a Kansas law enforcement training center reportedly saw a record number of women enter the program this year. So what is it really like to be a woman in law enforcement? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to give women in law enforcement the chance to answer that question for themselves. Heather Massey, Melanie Madonia, Dawn Lehman, hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start just very quickly going around the table, giving each of you the chance to state what it is that made you want to be a part of the police force, to become a police officer.
I grew up in a very small town as a farm girl, and I always saw police officers as somebody who helps others. And so as I grew up, I decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make a difference in our society and make a difference for the people who couldn't help themselves. So that's why I became a police officer.
Major Dawn Lehman?
For me, actually, my father was a New Jersey State Trooper. And I've been in law enforcement for 29 years, but seeing him in that position, I never saw any females. So really, it wasn't until I was a sophomore in college that I got involved in a little fender bender and a female officer showed up. So I kind of have brought that philosophy with me. You have to see to be. So seeing a female in that capacity and me relating that to what my dad had done, I was like, I can do this as well.
A light bulb went on.
Right. So I think moving forward, I've always said that you have to see to be, and even rising through the ranks in your organization, seeing somebody in those key positions allows you to envision that as well. And for me, it's really about helping people.
Okay, and Sergeant Melanie Madonia of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department.
Yes, for me, I didn't grow up thinking I was going to be a police officer. I wanted to be a professional football player. That didn't really, that wasn't realistic. And a professional.
For a lot of people, that's
right,
not realistic.
Right, and I, a professional basketball player, and I'm 5'5", and I can't really jump. So that wasn't an option either. However, when I was a kid, my dad was robbed at knife point, and my brother and I were in the car. We were 8 and 6. And I remember going to the police station, and there was a detective, and he just looked down at us and said, "Stop crying, you're fine." And I remember even as a little kid thinking, man, if I ever am one of those, I'm never going to make a kid feel like that. So as I'm 23 years old trying to figure out what to do, I thought, I remember that. And my brother was deployed at the time, and I really felt called to serve, but I knew I couldn't leave my 4-year-old daughter. It just isn't in me. And so I thought, what a way to serve. And so I decided that was what I was going to do.
That is a really powerful story. I want to ask each of you, and I'm going to start this time with you, Melanie. What do you think is the biggest challenge for women in law enforcement today, at least as far as you've experienced or observed where you work?
You know, I thought a lot about that after being asked to do that. And I really think we stand in our own way. I think that all the opportunities are there. And for whatever reason, whether it was your upbringing or the voice in your head or that one person telling you you can't, I think that when we get out of our own way and we just seek out those opportunities and work really hard, the opportunities are endless. And then empowering other women instead of seeing them as threats or that they have something to prove, bring them with you. Be that person that you needed as a young woman and do that for younger women. And I think those challenges will minimize as we go along.
You were talking about how to solve the challenges, but I still haven't heard you tell me what they are.
Oh.
It's just the biggest challenge. I know that's tricky because your comment that women in the police force can maybe be standing in their own way, that's fair, but how?
I don't really know the answer. When I say that, I'm saying that I don't think that there are as many challenges as we believe there to be. Now, are there people in the community that may not think that we can do what the men can do possibly? Are there people to our left and right that maybe think that we don't have the capabilities or strong enough? Perhaps. Do I think they're as prevalent as what we tell ourselves? I don't.
Don Lehman, what do you think?
I think times are changing. And I think, 20 or 30 years ago, it was significant in the culture of policing. We're trying to expand and being more diverse. So I think people are seeing the benefits of having diversity within their agency. So I think things are getting better in those lines. But I would have to agree that women kind of, they're their own worst enemy. They don't think that they can do the things that they can. One is because a lot of times we don't see people in those top positions. Women make up about 13% of all law enforcement personnel. Women in high-ranking leadership positions in their agency is only about 1 to 2% of all law enforcement. So not seeing people in those positions is hard for you to see yourself. There's a lot of agencies here that don't have high-ranking women in their agencies. So how do you aspire to be in that position if you don't see it? I think things are getting better, but we have a long way to go. I also think women, when they come into the organization, really have to prove themselves like twice as much as our male counterparts, because some things, if a male did it, may be seen as, that's just the norm, but it's really magnified. And I think as women coming into law enforcement, what we do reflects on everybody, all women in law enforcement, so much more than maybe your male counterpart.
So that's a lot of just a level of pressure,
right?
That can be a challenge.
Correct.
Heather Massey, what do you think? What do you think is the biggest challenge for women in law enforcement today?
I agree that stigma essentially is the biggest challenge. That stigma that's put on women that we're weaker. I see that from people I deal with out on the street. They assume that I am the weaker officer there when I'm on scene, and I don't believe that that's true in any way, shape, or form.
How do you get that feeling? What gives you that perception?
A lot of times somebody will maybe speak to me in a different way, have more attitude when they talk to me that they don't have with a male officer who's next to me. It doesn't last very long because I run a tight ship. And so I think that stigma is overcome very quickly once they see a female officer on scene.
You know, I once interviewed a journalist who got her start on the cops beat, and she'd show up at crime scenes. At least this is what she told me, with her notebook or whatever. And she said she really had to prove herself as a woman in that environment. And at first she got a lot of like flirty banter maybe. And instead of professionalism, a lot of people calling her things like sweetheart. This was in the 1980s. So maybe it's just different. But I'm wondering if there's a culture that you'd contend with behind the scenes, or if that's just unfamiliar.
I haven't seen that. My department would definitely not tolerate that. And if I saw that happening, I would definitely step in and make sure that that stopped immediately. But I don't see that at my department.
What about you two?
I think that is a culture within the agency. And I agree, too. Our department would not tolerate that. But I do think that there's obviously a shift with some of the things that we've seen here over the last year or so, that these things are out more in public and people notice that. So they're curbing, I think, their behavior. But there have been times showing up on a call or another female and, you know, somebody refers to them as hun or whatever, the citizens will. So I think, you know, times are changing. But again, we have a long way to go.
Well, call 816-235-2888 if you have a personal experience that shines light on what it means to be a woman in law enforcement, or maybe why it's important to have women in law enforcement. 816-235-2888. Let's hear our guests' stories. I want to start with Melanie Madonia. She's the sergeant in Kansas City, Missouri, who told us just a minute ago about her interactions as a young girl with a police officer or maybe a detective. Was it a detective?
I assume.
Yeah.
I was 8, so he was in a suit and he was really tall. That's all I remember.
He was big.
He was big.
Telling you to stop crying after you'd just seen your dad get robbed at knife point?
Right. yes, he just stop crying, you're fine. And I remember even thinking then, no, I'm not fine. You know, this unshakable man, my dad, is shaken. Of course I'm going to be a mess. And I just remember thinking, nope, I'll never have a kid feel like that if I ever get to do something like that. And I've carried that with me, and I don't. Once the scene is under control, I let my officers take over the scene, and I seek out the kids, because that's important to me, because they're the ones that suffer. They're the only ones in the entire situation that have no control.
Can you tell me a story about a time when you've sought out the kids and what you did, how you approached them?
There's probably a hundred, but the one in particular is there was a little girl, and I remember she had the same haircut I had when I was six, and she had freckles on her face, and she had lice in her hair, and she had been put in that home due to some, she was sexually abused in another home. And I remember we just developed a relationship, and I went back a few days later, and I went through the whole, do you know who is safe? Do you know what safe means? You know, are your teachers are safe? You know, am I safe? Police officers? And then we kind of went through the people she was around, and it came out that someone else in her home that she was currently in was not safe, and was able to develop that relationship and get her out of another home where she was being abused. But I remember if I hadn't taken the time to care about her and to talk to her, she probably would have continued to be in that environment. So
I'm really struck by this thing that you saw something of yourself just physically in her that kind of made that connection so fast, it sounds like.
Right, for sure. For me, I think, at least in my experience, those that serve usually have been through some sort of trauma or experience themselves. And so, same for me. So I see a lot of little Melanie and some of these kids. And so I just try to be the person that I needed when I was a kid.
So that's a pretty powerful argument for diversity in the police force. Just that you're going to respond in a really powerful kind of knowing way with someone who reflects you back to you.
Absolutely. That is the biggest thing that I've learned as I've matured. You know, I started the police academy when I was 23 years old, and I started out thinking I had to be someone I wasn't, that I had to be a guy or one of the guys. And that probably continued on for about a year, trying to prove something. And then when I let go of that mask and realized I had this whole set of God-given abilities and strengths, and I really brought those forward, everything opened up for me.
Take me back to that time when you were trying to be someone you weren't, that you had an idea of what a police officer was supposed to be like, and it sounds like you were almost trying to play the part.
Absolutely. It started out with a personality test in the academy, and everyone's testing a personality. I'm thinking, oh, man. All right, so maybe I answered the questions how I thought I needed to be, and everyone goes, oh, you're not an A personality. Well, surely I am, because this test says that, knowing full well I am not an A personality. Doesn't mean I don't have traits that will serve me well when it comes that time and place. However,
a whole team of A personalities also sounds terrifying to me.
And it's not a whole lot of fun, to be quite honest with you sometimes. So for me, I just had to embrace that my greatest quality is my heart, and there's nothing wrong with that. And actually, when I went to get promoted, they ask you, you know, your strengths and weaknesses, as in any other interview. And I said, I'm going to be honest with you. I came in here with a rehearsed thing to say, but you're going to hear that 100 times today, the same strengths. I said, my strength is my heart. And I said, sometimes that really hurts, but that's okay.
What do you mean, sometimes that really hurts?
Well, having a heart that bleeds for people gets you hurt a lot. You know, you carry that with you. When bad things happen, it doesn't go away the next call. But I think, man, if we didn't allow that to shine through, we're really missing out on the little girls that need us.
When you talked about that you were trying to prove yourself, can you tell me more about situations where you felt like you had to do that?
Absolutely. You know, just this tough guy act, or maybe I would run my mouth more, you know, to sound tough. Just literally when I look back, I'm like, who are you? You know, who is that? And I literally had to have that conversation with, who are you? That is not you at all.
But looking back, can you see things that were going on around you that maybe put that pressure on you? Or you really think that was totally coming from inside of yourself?
Oh, I'm sure there was that. I think it was perhaps a little bit of pressure to fit in and to be who these other people I believe them to be. But I really, I think it was an immaturity and a self-pressure, you know. And looking back now, if I knew then what I know now, love me or hate me, you know, I'm going to be Melanie. But, you know, that's the gift that I can give to younger women that are, you know, it's great when you come in and you're 30 and you already know who you are. But when you're 23, you have no idea. And
well, and it's hard to be new no matter what environment you're in, but especially as we've heard, if the picture you've seen of the profession you're in isn't you.
Absolutely.
I think it is really interesting that the visual of a large man in uniform telling you something that intimidated you or made you feel misunderstood as a kid, that that's part of what inspired you, that's the idea that there is a power of intimidation that comes with the uniform that comes. Am I reading too much into that?
No, it's all perception. Of course, as a child, yes, we are these huge bodies of influence and power and authority. And that can either be seen as something that is safe and trusted, or it can be something to fear. And that's our responsibility to form that opinion or that project that onto whoever we're interacting with, and especially children, because they've got the whole world telling them that police are people to fear. Sometimes their experiences, you know, the first time they might ever see us, we're taking daddy to jail, whether right, wrong, or indifferent. And until they see a different perspective of us, that we really are safe and we're here to help them, then why wouldn't they fear us?
What makes you feel empowered in the work you do?
The ability to help others, not only the community, but the officers who work for me, to be able to support them and just to help people. And that sounds really cliche. I think they both said the same thing, but it truly is having the power. It's not the power to exercise authority over other people. It's having the ability to help people when they're at their absolute lowest and they need you more than anything else. That's what's empowering, that you can help them.
You're also a mom. You mentioned that before. Does that affect your relationship with police work?
Oh, absolutely. People always say, oh, you're a cop all the time. Absolutely not. I can hang that up when I get home. What I don't hang up is being a mom. And so that carries over a lot into my supervision. And my interactions in the community. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that maternal instinct, I think that really helps, because you can scan a room and you might see something that only a mother could see.
Can you give an example of that?
Probably not. but just to go, you know, that little girl.
Yeah.
Even though I had that experience of, man, that's little Melanie, I had that it was in the pit of my stomach. I knew something wasn't right. And that's my experience as a mom. That's that instinct that was given to me. So yeah, we use it a lot. I use it a lot.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to get a couple of more stories and some national perspective on women in law enforcement in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. You can join us at 816-235-2888. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about police culture, police work, and what it's like to be in that culture and do that work as a woman. We've just spoken with Melanie Madonia from Kansas City, Missouri's Patrol Division. Now let's turn to Major Don Lehman. Hi, Don.
Hi.
So in addition to being a major with the Lenexa Police Department, you've been president of the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives twice.
Correct.
So you have an interest in this topic.
I do.
Talk to me, first of all, about that organization, what you do, and how you think it might be changing things.
Yeah, so the National Association of Women Law Enforcement Executives, we call NALE, basically was started about 20 years ago from five chiefs. One actually was my former chief, Chief Alan Hansen of the Lenexa Police Department. They were at an International Association of Chiefs of Police conference. So it's 20 years ago. They're walking around. There's five of them. Many people think that they're a chief's wife because, I mean, there was a limit. So they saw the need to kind of band together, started this organization, and it's grown over the years. I was fortunate enough to go to my first NALE conference in 1995, which was the first NALE conference, and became involved in the organization. And then in 2009, became president of the organization. And really, it's about helping women know what their obstacles are, because as we said earlier, we're our own worst obstacle.
That interests me, that because part of I understand that there's something empowering about saying, hey, you know, objectively speaking, the opportunities are there and I'm not going to let anything stand in my way. Totally appreciate that. But there has to be something in the environment that makes that kind of self-talk necessary to begin with.
Well, I think if you look at it, it's not just in law enforcement, but there's a great article by the Harvard Business Review regarding engineering profession. Women, when a position comes out or a promotion will come out, they will look at the job requirements. And if women don't match about 9 out of 10 of those requirements, they will not put in for that promotion. However, male counterpart, they match about 5 or 6, they're putting in for it. So it's having that confidence to work outside of your box to put in for some of those positions. So,
well, and it sounds like maybe some of the pressures that we're talking about aren't necessarily limited to the police culture. It's just culture.
Correct. And I think women, they want to be sure that they're going to succeed, whereas a lot of times our male counterparts, if they can check half, they're putting in for it. So NALE actually brings women together at our organization, or at our annual conference, so that we can talk to each other, network.
Maybe give you some of that confidence?
Oh, definitely. And seeing women in leadership positions, we talk about bringing people along. So in a position where I'm at now, I'm a major in Lenexa, I have the ability to bring people with me to that conference. So being in control of your own sphere, bringing civilians along, police officers who may have only had 2 years on the job, bringing them to an organization where they see captains, majors, chiefs of their organizations is very inspiring. It was inspiring to me when I went, and that's part of what our association does. We have a mentoring program where maybe I could be mentored by somebody on the East Coast and exchange these ideas to help them through this promotion process.
So remind me, how much of the police force nationwide is made up of women?
About 13%.
And how many of those women are in leadership positions?
1-2% in top positions within their agencies.
Do we know what that looks like locally?
As far as female chiefs?
Yeah, or just other leader, like pretty high-ranking leadership positions like yours.
So right now we have one female chief in the region. Ellen Hansen used to be a chief in the region, but really in our region, it's pretty small. We have some regions in South Carolina, Southern California, where we have about 6 female chiefs. That's great to see. And I think as NALE grows, what we would like to see is, you know, we see first female chief. It is not having firsts anymore. It'd just be nice. And about 2 years ago, we actually saw our first female chief being replaced by a female chief. That was a big thing. Some of that succession where, hey, we're not...
That it wasn't like novelty's worn off.
Right. It's just, but seeing a female chief replace a female chief in the same position, that's good, good for us, good for women in law enforcement. But we have a long way to go in that.
So how do you think that police work itself or police culture or just how people in this country relate to law enforcement, anything along those lines would be different just in substance, if we saw more women in the kind of position you're talking about. 1 to 2% is tiny.
It is very. But I would just say, the discussion we just had about being diverse in your organizations. We don't want cookie cutters in our cookie cutter of the same people. So everybody brings value, whatever their background is, whether it's race, religion, sexual orientation, whatever. We all bring value to the organization. So the more diverse we can be, we can relate to specific situations, and your coworkers see how you relate in that position, and it makes them better as well. So I think that's kind of the goal moving forward.
I want to get back to your story. I mean, you've been doing this work for almost 3 decades. Is that right?
Yes.
Were you intimidated? I mean, I'm first of all curious about how you've seen doing this work as a woman. Have you seen it change in 3 decades?
As far as women in law enforcement?
Yeah.
I definitely have. I think when we look back even into local government, we see more women mayors, more elected officials that are women. And I think it's just culture. I mean, we're just trying to catch up. So I think people have seen, and mayors and city administrators have seen what that diversity brings. So now they're looking at hiring women as chiefs in their region or for their community. So it's just kind of gradually taking shape.
Earlier, we talked about the story of how you got started and that your father had been, was it a sheriff?
A New Jersey State Trooper.
State Trooper.
Right.
And that you had really admired him, but it hadn't occurred to you that you could be in law enforcement yourself until you saw a woman working as a police officer when you were in college. But then once you actually got into it, can you take me back to those early days of, you mentioned also earlier that you felt maybe you had to prove yourself a little extra.
I think for me, it was more a sense of pride because I knew that I was one of a few people, a few women in the organization. So whatever I did would affect people coming behind. And I'm a competitive person. I played sports. So I want to be good at what I do. And I want to be the best that I can be. So it was always trying to strive to that. But then when younger officers or new women came on board, it was really just talking to them and saying, hey, look, you're going to be put under the microscope. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's the way it is. But you just need to be who you are and try to strive to be better.
Can you give me an example of a time when you felt like you were under a microscope?
I think really just even in like the early stages in the FTO program, is in our field training officer program, is just going through things and seeing how I handled a situation versus, you know, maybe how a male counterpart handled the situation, and just how you were necessarily evaluated in that realm. But, you know, just making sure that I was doing what I needed to do to get through that call.
And so you felt like you were being held to a higher standard?
Yes. I mean, I think that's even still today, because I hear stories from across the country that is the same thing. The other thing we see, too, across the country, if a female officer is involved in something, the female part is always accentuated. It's a female officer did this, or a female officer was involved in a shooting.
Not just an officer.
Exactly.
You are a major in the Lenexa Police Department. First of all, what does that mean?
So in our rank structure, we have a chief of police, major, captains, sergeant. So I'm second in command of the police department.
Tell me about your climb through the ranks to get there.
I had a very supportive, and I think, too, being exposed to some of the people across the country, some people have had it a lot rougher than I did. But I came into an organization that had a female chief. She started NOLI. So I started out, ahead of the game, so to speak, but really just having the support of people within the organization to allow me to do what I needed to do in order to improve and to encourage me. My current chief Chief Hongslow, he is very supportive of women. He understands that the value that diversity brings to our organization. Nolly hosts a breakfast every year at the IACP conference. He comes to that breakfast every year, supports our organization, supports us bringing younger less tenured officers to the conference, even civilians to the conference.
That is very cool to hear. Well, there's still just the tiniest bit of time. If you want to jump in on this conversation with women in law enforcement at 816-235-2888, let's bring Heather Massey in on this. She's a police sergeant in Liberty. And Heather, do you relate to what you're hearing so far, or do you feel like your perspective is different?
I definitely relate. When I first became an officer, I worked at a very small agency, so there weren't other women. And
just so, no other women at all.
No. And so I felt like my first few weeks, I was being watched. I felt I didn't really feel like part of the group initially, but that could happen to anyone. I would assume everyone feels a little out of place when they start. However, I kind of felt like when I went on calls for service, there would be more people tag along when I was the person who was responding to that call. But that quickly changed. As soon as you prove yourself, the other officers are quickly go into the everyone understands we're all here to do a job and we can all do it. We may have to do it differently. I'm not a very big person. And so fighting, I can do it if I have to, and I will cheat if I have to win.
Wait, how do However, you cheat when fighting?
That's why we get this Batman belt.
What?
With all of the tools.
Oh, I see.
Of our trade, so that we don't have to, I don't have to use my upper body strength to beat the 6 foot, 200 pound man who decides he doesn't want to go to jail today. That's why I have this equipment. And I think as a woman, I'm more likely to use that training than to get into a knockdown drag out with someone. I have to use my skills, my verbal skills, my verbal judo to make sure that I don't get in those situations because it's not going to be a fair fight.
You said that once you proved yourself, it was all good. Can you identify a moment along the way where you thought like that it just happened?
You get in your first fight.
Tell me about it.
It's been 19 years ago. But the first time you get in and somebody steps up to you and says, I'm not going, and you don't back down, that's the moment when everyone's like, okay, if I get into a fight, she's got my back. I don't have to worry about anything to do with her. She's going to be there when I need her help. That's what it is.
In the day-to-day, what are some of the issues that still come up for you being a woman in police work that would never occur to someone outside the police force? Like, I would never have thought about this belt around you and what it symbolizes for you, what it means to you. But also might not even cross the mind of a male officer working right beside you.
Going to the bathroom is quite an obstacle for us female officers.
Why?
Because we have to take this whole belt off just to go to the restroom. So I can't stop at Quick Trip and go to the bathroom. That's not an option for me. Because where am I going to put all of this gear?
I safely, can't put it on the floor. Especially, yeah.
You know, it's a safety issue. So sometimes I have to go back to the station to take a bathroom break, where other officers don't have to do that. I was on the SWAT team for about 7 years on our department, and if you're outside for a long period of time on a barricaded party, you've got to figure out how to go to the bathroom with all of your gear. So that's something that, as a woman, I deal with. Uniforms. When I first started in law enforcement, the departments I was at did not buy women's uniforms if they made them at that point. Now it's a little better, but it's still difficult to find a vest that fits comfortably. It's still difficult to find pants that actually allow for hips after you have children. Things like that that people don't think of that we kind of just have to deal with.
What about you're calling them tools. I mean, I feel like the lay term is weapons, but maybe is that unfair for me to generalize?
I would say that's unfair.
Okay.
We have all sorts of things. Like, we have our taser. We have a baton. We have pepper spray. We have lots of other tools that we can use at our disposal other than weapons.
Right. I guess my real question is, using these tools and things, do you feel like your use of them is the same as the men you work with?
We may use them a little differently, but the basic training is using essentially kinetic energy to get people to do what you want to do instead of having to use force.
You mentioned that your first fight that you got in was 19 years ago, and I asked Dawn if things had changed in the almost 30 years she's been doing this. What about for you? Have you witnessed change?
Definitely. And I don't know how much of that change was from a small department in rural Missouri to a larger suburban department, because that's where I saw most of the changes. But definitely society accepts women police officers a lot more than they used to. We used to be the novelty. We used to be the, you have to have so many on your department. And I don't see that anymore. People look at us as equal to our male counterparts, and that's the way I want to see it.
Like Melanie, you're a mom. How has that played into your career?
Oh, that's definitely made big changes in my career. Like when I was on the SWAT team and was on call, I remember being at a movie one time with my children, and halfway through the movie, my phone rang and we had to get up and leave. And that was just devastating to my kids. But they understand that I'm trying to make the world a better place for them. And so I make it up to them as best I can at a later date. But they haven't always got to eat dinner with mom. You know, like a lot of families have mealtime, they don't always get to do that. And I've heard my oldest before say to friends that, you know, people will be like, oh, it's really cool that your mom's a cop. And she's like, it's not always really cool. She doesn't get to come to all of my school things. She doesn't get to come to everything I want her to come to. So she sees that she has to live without me sometimes. But she also, on many occasions, has told me that she's proud of what I do. She's proud that I'm out there trying to help other people who can't help themselves.
What are the greatest rewards of police work for you?
The greatest rewards are when you see that you've made a difference in someone else's life. When I was a school resource officer, I had a student who had behavior disorder issues and was restrained on a daily basis so that she wouldn't hurt other people. She and I became friends. And after she graduated high school, we still once a month would get together and have lunch so that I could see how she was doing. When she moved out on her own, I checked in on her once a month. We would meet and I would buy her lunch so that we could make sure she was doing okay. We don't just fix the short-term problems. I think as women, we want to fix the long-term problem.
Sergeant Heather Massey of the Liberty Police Department, thank you. And Sergeant Melanie Madoni of the Kansas City, Missouri Patrol Division, Major Don Lyman with us from Lenexa, thank you both too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been great getting to know you all. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll talk about some news out of Westport when we return. Stay with us. So last week, a Facebook post by a Westport bartender went semi-viral. The guy was telling a story about a Westport security guard who stopped by the bar where he works and ordered, prepare for, this is offensive, he ordered a Trayvon martini. And it only got worse from there with some racist instructions on how to make a drink by that name. KCUR has followed up on the story with Andrea Tudhope reporting that the guard in question has since been fired. But let's step back and look at what this says about safety and race in Westport. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guest is Aaron Randall of the Kansas City Star. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. You have done lots of reporting on race in Westport, including ways in which venues sometimes signal who's welcome and who's not. But in the story we just heard about this Westport security guard, is there anything new for you?
I think perhaps the most alarming and the new factor that I kind of encountered with this particular incident was just the brazenness of it, right? You have someone who is making an alarmingly racist comment. And then when you double down on that and consider that this person is a member of law enforcement, this person carries a gun and is charged with protecting people of all races and creeds in the Westport district, that just adds another level of kind of alarm and just shock to the issue.
The bartender was careful to point out that there were witnesses, and he also pointed out how those witnesses reacted to what they'd heard. That part was also troubling to me. Can you, first of all, recap that piece of it for our listeners?
Yes. Are you talking about how he kind of doubled down on what happened?
Yeah, and that that there was someone he worked with who kind of passed by and walked away. And
yeah, that was interesting. And basically what happened, the bartender, and this is all not necessarily, I mean, it's alleged, right? It's still essentially he said, she said, because I haven't been able to speak to anyone who would confirm or corroborate these claims, even though there was an investigation by Chesley International, the company that employs this guard. And they, you know, he did end up getting fired. The bartender told me that he had a manager and a server, and he lists this in his post, that heard the remarks and were just as shocked as he was. And I actually was able to find out who that manager and the server were, and I tried to contact both of them, and they weren't willing to speak with me. One of them actually went so far as to change his name on Facebook after I'd found him, thinking that he could escape my reach. And I found that in a larger context, I found that very telling and very indicative of the reporting of what I've seen in my reporting on this topic, which is I don't want to say complicit, but there is an element present in these situations where you have people who are witnesses to wrongdoing or to, just racism. And I found in my reporting that they have not always been willing to come forth and speak truth to that power or to go on record and say, like, I have seen this happen. And on a larger scale, I feel like that's kind of, you know, it's really it can be in a way troubling. Because I think that it's important, particularly in our community, to have people on both sides saying, I see this issue happening. I see it going on. This is not just in people's heads. And I found that also in my previous reporting when I did my story on the social scene. Off the record, I had a number of Westport owners and patrons who would tell me, yeah, we've definitely seen, you know, people of color be treated differently. But, oh, I can't go on record and say that because that might affect my business.
That's so the thing about the bartender himself, he's a black man, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, the thing in his post that really struck me was this idea that he was left really to deal with this alone. And mm-hmm. a reference to Trayvon Martin, that could feel really like a not just a racist comment, but also a threat.
Yeah, and speaking with the bartender further, you know, he had very real anxieties about the situation. He did not know this man. He didn't know how he would react to this sudden rash of publicity of this incident, what that meant for him personally, whether that put him in danger. You know, he did feel alone in a way, and I just kind of can't understate the importance of and the significance of when we have those of other cultures, those who realize and who see the marginalization happening, when they don't speak up, that is in a way coddling, and it's complicit to the racism in a way. And I think that's one of the major issues that I found is, you know, with Kansas City specifically, there has been kind of this reluctance to really to have the conversation, right, and to attack these issues head on. And I think that's one of our biggest impediments when it comes to overcoming this issue as a whole.
Talk to me about your sense of how safe people of color feel as Westport employees, because that's a piece of this conversation that I haven't really heard before, but it's part of what I hear in this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that kind of swirling around all this, right, I have to admit that I think Westport does a better job of inclusivity and making people feel safe and welcome than most social spaces in this city. And I think people may find that kind of confusing. Like, well, if that's the case, why do you do the reporting? And why do you seem to kind of harp on Westport? But in a larger sense, I think that it is fascinating from a storytelling and a reporting standpoint to show that this district that essentially is the best that we have to offer is still woefully inadequate, right? It's still not a safe space where people feel comfortable and people feel welcome. And this is the best we have to offer.
When you say this is the best we have to offer, what do you mean by that?
I kind of mean just, I think that looking at Westport, when I compare it to the Power and Light District, I compare it to Crossroads or Waldo or Overland Park, Lenexa, all these great bubbling social spheres and just scenes that we have in the city. I think that Westport is where people overall feel the most included, the most welcomed. I think, you know, Power and Light obviously has its own issues. Waldo sometimes can feel very, you know, neighborhood and like nativist. That's an appropriate way to kind of sum it up. I think Crossroads can sometimes feel very, you know, slanted towards artists and the artisans. But I think Westport has everything. You know, you have hip hop clubs in Westport. You have the artist community. You have a neighborhood feel. You have, you know, bars that cater to a wide range and swath of people. And it's geographically in the center of, you know, the metro area. I think all those things can contribute to Westport being, you know, one of the places that people choose first when it comes to kind of going out and thinking like, I'll have a good time tonight.
So people actually do come together there. At least physically come together,
yeah.
Which maybe is part of why tensions bubble over there too.
Yeah, that's kind of a double-edged sword, right? Like, in a way, their biggest asset can sometimes be, you know, a conduit for tension in a way, because so many people come together in that space. It also creates opportunity for tension.
I hear that there has been sensitivity training or like diversity training in Westport.
Sure.
Do you think that that is something that helps? I mean, when you hear about a story like what we're talking about here, does training prevent that? Or does someone who orders a Trayvon martini, like, is that person beyond sensitivity training?
I won't say that training doesn't help, right? I think that training brings it to the table, you know, for however long, you know, that training may exist. But I mean, when you think of it on a different level, you know, we have sexual harassment training in our workplace, and we haven't eradicated, you know, sexual harassment there. You know, I think that this is a Band-Aid on an issue that requires surgery in a way. I think that this will, in order to really combat and have this conversation, it takes a lot more than just training, though training is a necessary step.
What, when you say it takes more, what does more include?
From what I see, and just knowing the history of Kansas City, I think that we are entering a period of needing strategic and systemic municipal interference on this kind of issue. And I'm not going to get on Fannie Lou Hamer's radio and tell you that I'm a specialist or an expert on City Hall or economic policy or how these things work. But I really feel that we need the leaders that we hold accountable to represent us and to have our best interests in heart, the leaders that we trust to make our city greater, the leaders that we trust to lead. We need to have more involvement and more systemic involvement in fostering diversity in these spaces. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know where that conversation starts, but I think that that is where we need to go. I think that if we just hope and pray that one day people look around, join hands and sing Kumbaya, and it's all taken care of, that that in a way is being a little bit foolish.
Do you know whether people like the highest leaders in Kansas City, the mayor, other kinds of people in really high up leadership positions citywide have responded to this story, or does it not reverberate that far?
Well, of course, I can't see everything, right? But I will say that over time, I do feel like the response has largely been impotent. Funny story, when I did the Westport story about a year ago.
About venues and the ways that they're sometimes excluding Black people.
Yes, yes. I had a New York Times reporter contact me, and he frankly asked, like, what's up with your city, man? And when I hear that, it's like, wait, what do you mean? And he was kind of like, you know, you had a man on record saying that he employs racist practices to keep people out of these spaces. And I didn't hear a peep from City Hall. I didn't hear a peep from politicians. I didn't hear a peep from City Council. And I found that very telling. And when I spoke to Mayor Sly James, we were talking on Twitter a few months ago. He had not even heard of the story, he said. So that is alarming to me that this is such a pervasive issue and our representatives don't seem to really be that cognizant of it.
Well, Aaron Randall, so much more to talk about here, and we will do that sometime. But thank you for joining us from the Kansas City Star.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to see KCUR's reporting on this story, you can get it at kcur.org. And that's a wrap for today's show. Keep talking about all of this on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and we'd love to hear your perspectives. You can catch anything you missed this morning later today at kcur.org/Central Standard. We talked about women in law enforcement and just now race in Westport. kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, tune in for a chat about the East Bottoms and how that part of town might be changing. We'll also hear highlights from StoryCorps after a month-long stop in Kansas City. All of that happens tomorrow at 10, so join us. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.